Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the real story behind the most legendary couple in ancient history, and have historians and Hollywood done them justice? Traditional accounts of Antony and Cleopatra make us think of a dashing, powerful soldier and his glamorous, deeply devoted lover, who dramatically committed suicide within weeks after her lover died in her arms of a self-inflicted stab wound in the aftermath of defeat at the Battle of Actium. But as my guest today will tell us, while the pair may indeed have been deeply in love, from the beginning their devotion to one another had at least as much strategic value as emotional significance. Historian Adrian Goldsworthy explores the whole complicated and fascinating story in his new book, Antony and Cleopatra. Adrian, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much. Nice to be invited.
I think a big surprise for a lot of people who believe they know the story is that Cleopatra wouldn't have considered herself culturally Egyptian at all.
Not in any way. I mean, you have to remember her family gets there after Alexander the Great has stormed out of Macedon and conquered half of the known world. And she's a descendant of Greek and Macedonian aristocracy. She's speak Greek as her first language. She's actually the first one in her family who've ruled Egypt for 250 years, and she's the first one to bother to learn to speak Egyptian at all. So, you know, you have to think of her not as this heavily eyeshadowed and sort of, you know, Egyptian-style ruler, but very much as a Greek woman. And, you know, the Greeks had the most advanced form of education of the day, so she's part of that culture.
So she was, in fact, very bright, as far as anybody can tell.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's quite clear. Obviously, they talk about her as a linguist. You know, apart from Egyptian, apart from Greek, she's speaking about eight other languages. She's credited as a scholar. She's certainly at the center. Alexandria had the famous library, where the idea was to collect absolutely every book in Greek, and it's where they, you know, they translated the Hebrew scriptures into Greek. They wanted the knowledge of the world. And this is a place of great education. It's the philosophers that are paid for by the royal family there. These were the people who would have tutored her when she was young. So, you know, she was a very bright, very well-educated, very sophisticated person.
And there was no question from the beginning that it was understood that she would either have entirely the throne to herself or at least share power.
She was always going to have to share power. It was very difficult for one person to rule the kingdom, particularly for a woman. You normally needed a king and a queen, a male consort and female consort. And the problem was with the family is that there is no obvious succession to the eldest. So it's any one of your brothers or sisters can be a challenger to you, can be a rival. So, yes, she's likely to rule, but she's also got to watch everyone around her because she can't trust them, and they will kill her to get to power.
And she was married to her brother?
Probably. We're not quite sure. She certainly rules jointly with two of her brothers. The first one is when they start the rule, he's only about 11. So the odds are, even if they are married, that, you know, it's not going to be a real marriage. The other one also significantly younger than her. And both of them, one of them's killed off by Julius Caesar and the other one is probably poisoned by Cleopatra herself. So whether they married or not, there probably wasn't a lot of affection between the two.
Yeah, it becomes very clear that family ties were a tricky thing for the Ptolemies. Blood relation was no guarantee whatsoever of allegiance.
No, that was the problem, because they tried to make the blood of the family special so that only they could be rulers of Egypt. And the idea was to protect themselves. But the problem with that is that then it means that, you know, although you're marrying off brothers to sisters and uncles to nieces to try and keep the royal blood very separate, not allow the aristocracy to get any connection whatsoever, but it does come back to this problem that absolutely any of your brothers or sisters, of your relatives, can be king or queen. And there's always going to be somebody amongst the people at court, the politicians, the aristocracy, who will lose out if you're the ruler, so he's willing to support somebody else and back them against you. So even if they're not too, you know, badly disposed towards you, the odds are that someone will plot to put them in power and gain power themselves. So it's very, very dangerous. I mean, Cleopatra was probably in fear of her life just about, well, as soon as she was aware enough, old enough to be aware, and then for the rest of her life.
What did she look like?
That's very, very hard to say because we have so little information. You know, you have images on coins, but you've got to remember these aren't the, you know, they're not pinups. They're not the cover of a fashion magazine or something. These are there to stress your power. And it just so happened that the first Ptolemy had sort of rather pop eyes and a really hooked nose. So if you want to prove you're a true Ptolemy, you have to look like that. So the coins have this rather sort of fierce-looking image who doesn't look at all beautiful or attractive. The ancient sources vary. They tend to emphasize that it was her personality, her charisma, the music of her voice and her liveliness that made her so attractive, but then go on to say, and she was quite beautiful as well. Others just emphasize the beauty. So I think there was someone who was certainly charismatic, someone you would have to notice, but what coloring they were, what color hair, what color eyes, we don't know any of these things at all.
Meanwhile, we have the very powerful Roman Republic, not yet the Roman Empire that it would become under Augustus Caesar. Talk about what state it was in under Julius Caesar in the years before his assassination.
The Roman Republic really is dying in the first century BC, even as people like Caesar is born around about 100 BC, Antony in the 80s, a little bit later. It started to tear itself apart, first of all in political violence. You get assassination, rioting in the Forum. Then it escalates to the point where when a politician is thwarted, he will go and raise an army, and he will take that army, seize Rome by force, kill his opponents. So although it still has the trappings of democracy, you've still got elected magistrates, all these things, the system is falling to pieces. And the rivalry has just become so violent and vicious that the Republic is internally disordered, but in terms of its foreign policy, what it's doing in the world, it's going to success after success. It's beaten off all the rivals that were in any way serious. There's nobody left in the Mediterranean world that can challenge the Romans that is anything like their equal. So they've grown to dominate that world. They're spreading out. I mean, Julius Caesar would take his legions up to the Atlantic coast, northern France. He'd raid Britain, though he wouldn't stay there. He'd cross the Rhine into Germany. Other people had taken the armies as far out as the Euphrates in the east, as the Sahara in North Africa. So the Romans are expanding. They're doing very very, very successful when it comes to foreign policy. It's just internally they're in turmoil.
We know, of course, that there's this famous conspiracy brewing in the Senate against Julius Caesar. One of his trusted lieutenants, though, was Mark Antony. Can you talk about what we know about his early life?
Yes, it's not perhaps what we'd expect. He's talked about very much. He's someone who comes from an aristocratic family. You know, his name, Antonius, is one that voters would recognize, that people would choose in an election. He comes from a well-established group, and there were a few families like that that really dominated public life at Rome, and it was very hard to fight your way into that inner circle. But Antony also inherits huge debts, so as he's growing up, even when he's a teenager, he's declared bankrupt. He can't accept half of the legacies of his father because they've been so heavily mortgaged that he could never afford to pay it off. He doesn't enter politics till very late in life for a Roman. He doesn't go off on military service at the age a Roman normally would. He basically has a rather wild youth. You know, one friend of his is accused of sort of introducing him to wine and women, and Antony takes to both rather naturally and then just parties his way through his teens and 20s. And it's not until he's in his mid-20s that he starts doing anything in public service at all, which is very, very late for a Roman. So he's a bit abnormal, but he's got that assurance that because of who he is, because of his family name, that he simply deserves to be at the top. Doesn't really matter about his abilities, doesn't really matter what he does. I'm an Antonius, I ought to be leading the Republic.
Did Caesar have a great deal of influence on his political philosophy?
As far as we can see, Antony doesn't really have a political philosophy at all. He's very much an opportunist. You know, he feels he has this right to be at the top, but throughout his life, you can't see him taking up any particular cause. Somebody like Julius Caesar again and again comes back to certain issues, the land redistribution for the poor, the rights of provincials, people in the occupied provinces of the Roman Empire, trying to protect them from corrupt governors. Antony simply passes legislation that will give him personal profit, personal advantage. It's very short term. So he doesn't really have any ambition apart from for Antony himself. So he's a different type of politician to Caesar, perhaps because he felt he had less to prove. Caesar was more from the margins of politics. He had to sort of force his way to the top. But also, I think his character is very, very different.
One thing I have to say, Adrian, that I hadn't fully understood before I read the book was that by the turn of the first century, to stay in power in Egypt, you in fact really needed the support of Rome. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, yes, that's certainly true. And it's the one mistake we make if we ever see Cleopatra as in any way challenging Rome. By the second century BC, her family had been killing each other off with such sort of free abandon for for generations. The kingdom had started to decline. The administration had gone to pot. They didn't have much of an army left. And they avoided being destroyed by the Romans by never fighting them. But instead, they embraced Rome. And they said, right, as a king, if I go to Rome and the Romans back me, then that's the only way I will stay in power. So in Cleopatra's case, I mean, she would have been dead or exiled before she was 21 if Julius Caesar hadn't come along. Her father had spent most of his reign, about 20 years, bribing Roman politicians like Caesar, like Pompey, simply to get acceptance, simply to stay in power. You have to prove that you're a loyal ally and you will give the Romans whatever they want, which is largely the money and the grain and other resources that the rich agriculture of Egypt can produce. So right the way through, she's dependent on the Romans. She is always a loyal ally of Rome. But the problem is, because the Romans are having all these civil wars, who is Rome? If you back one politician, if you get his support, that's fine, but then suddenly he loses a civil war or gets murdered, and you've got to start again with the people who seize power. So it's very, very difficult. It's another reason why her position is so very precarious, and she has to be a skillful, quick-thinking politician simply to survive.
Historian Adrian Goldsworthy is my guest this hour. We're talking about his new book, Antony and Cleopatra. We'll resume that conversation in just a couple of minutes. Right now, we want to take this opportunity to give you this opportunity to support the station, support the programming that contributes so much to what you understand about the world, both ancient and modern and everywhere in between. Your way to do this is to go online to kera.org or to call 1-888-694-6931. Send us a little money.
Yeah, that's Chris Boyd. I'm Jeff Whittington, and we're getting the rare opportunity today to revisit a fantastic guest and a program that aired during a membership campaign back in September that we thought was just so great. It's sort of a best of show today, and Adrian Goldsworthy is one of those historians and researchers who we love to feature on the station. And his book, Antony and Cleopatra, is available today for you, as it was in the fall. For a $120 membership donation to KERA, you can go to kera.org and do that, or call 888-694-6931. Whichever way you do it, whichever thank you gift you want, please do your part right now. Please do it today.
I always like talking to people in whatever field that are able to bust a few myths about somebody. And I think, Goldsworthy does such a good job in the book and in this interview talking about the fact that the Cleopatra we picture from the movies is not actually who the real person was. And I think it's really wonderful to be able to do that, in journalism as a whole, and certainly that's the idea, and definitely in public radio. Our idea is to tell you what actually happened as opposed to perpetuating the myths about things. And your support makes this kind of content possible. Call us at 1-888-694-6931 or make a contribution at kera.org. If you do $120 or more, you can choose to receive a copy of Antony and Cleopatra by Adrian Goldsworthy.
Here's something that's actually happening, Chris.
Actually happening.
Stuart Copeland, founding member and drummer of The Police, is coming to town in February because the Dallas Symphony Orchestra and the local percussion ensemble D-Drum is going to premiere his new percussion composition.
Apparently he's an extraordinary composer.
He's fantastic. I mean, he's a great musician. He's done so much incredible work. Well, we have a really special, special thank you gift, and we only have two pairs of tickets to this. This is an evening with Stuart Copeland.
That's sounding extra special.
This is an evening with Stuart Copeland. 7 p.m. on Tuesday, February 1st, at the home of a member of the Dallas Symphony Orchestra Guild.
Wow.
He's going to do a performance, apparently. It's going to be an evening with Stuart Copeland, and there's two pairs available for a contribution of $350. You have to call 888-694-6931 to take advantage of this incredibly limited and special offer.
First come, first served, obviously. I'm guessing this is only a credit card
contribution or debit card?
Okay. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number to take advantage of that offer, or simply to take advantage of loving KERA and making a contribution. You can also go to kera.org and you can make a contribution of $120 or more this hour and receive a copy of Adrian Goldsworthy's book, Antony and Cleopatra. Whatever amount you want to give, whatever thank you gift you do or don't choose, your support remains important to us, and we thank you for it.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is historian Adrian Goldsworthy. His new book is called Antony and Cleopatra. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Adrian, you talked before the break about the importance for the Ptolemies of embracing Rome in order to hang on to their power in Alexandria. Cleopatra did this quite literally with Julius Caesar, and there are some wonderful stories of how she initially made her way into his palace. Can you talk about what the most likely scenario is there?
I mean, obviously, we have to be a bit careful because some of our sources are inclined to, you know, tell us a good story. That's why we're repeating it now. Mm-hmm. But although Caesar and she had obviously been corresponding because she's been forced out by her brother's forces, she's tried to fight her way back into Egypt, but she hasn't got the military strength to do it. Caesar has come into Egypt. He's besieged in Alexandria by the brother, so summons her. But, of course, she's got to get through all the guards set by her brother who really wants her dead and out of the way. So the story is that it's not that she's wrapped up in a carpet, as, you know, a la Hollywood and Elizabeth Taylor and all that sort of thing, but in fact she's in what's probably a laundry bag. That's the best translation of the Greek. So she's rowed across in a small boat over the harbor, sneaks into the palace area, helped by just one attendant, and then is brought into Caesar's room, and the attendant undoes the tie strings on the top of the bag. The bag falls down. She stands up. It's slightly weirdly like a dancer popping out of a cake, which is not quite the same as the sort of the rolling gracefully out of a carpet idea. But that seems to be what happened. And, you know, we're told that she'd very carefully prepared herself to look both a little bit disheveled and pathetic because she wanted Caesar's sympathy, but also strong and attractive. And, you know, Julius Caesar's a great womanizer, and he likes intelligent, bright, rather exciting people, much like himself, although he's a lot older. So I think the two of them sense an affinity right from the beginning, and they very quickly, again, both need each other politically. Cleopatra needs him to get back from exile. He needs her as something to use against her brother. But there's also a personal spark. So it's always the mixture, politics and the passion as well.
And she did bear him a son. Was there any expectation whatever that he might somehow inherit power as the son of Caesar?
Not at all, or at least not at all in the Roman context. Clearly, Cleopatra is hoping and presents him as her successor in her own kingdom of Egypt herself. So he's there, and the fact that he's Ptolemy called the Little Caesar or Caesarion does no harm at all. But Caesar himself doesn't really figure in her propaganda for her own realm. You know, she doesn't need him. In Rome, Ptolemy Caesarion isn't a Roman citizen, which means he doesn't have any political rights. He's not even legitimate anyway, so he doesn't have any rights whatsoever. He can't inherit anything from Caesar's will. He's not even mentioned in it. So there's a tendency to exaggerate and to think in modern terms that somehow this was a threat to Octavian, Caesar's adopted son, the man who'd become Caesar Augustus, the first emperor. Caesarion isn't really in any meaningful way. He's just an embarrassment for Caesar. You know, Roman politicians shouldn't go around having illegitimate children with foreigners. It's only that. There's not really any political danger.
Did he and Cleopatra part on good terms?
With Caesar, certainly. I mean, she's one of many affairs that Caesar has. He's not faithful to any of his three or four wives, and he goes on within months of having had the affair with Cleopatra. He has an affair with another queen further along the North African coast. So, you know, even his mistresses can't really trust him. On the other hand, he's put her in power, and she comes to Rome within a year or so to confirm this, to be formally acknowledged by the Roman Republic, Caesar pointing them in the right direction, that she is now acknowledged Queen of Egypt. And then she appears again just before Caesar's murdered, and she's in Rome when he's killed. That's probably because he needs her support for his planned expedition to Parthia, sort of modern-day Iran-Iraq, roughly. He's planning this big military campaign that'll last several years. He needs money to fund that. He needs grain to feed those soldiers, and Egypt can provide both of those. So there's a political element, but probably, again, it's quite likely that some of the passion, some of the affair is still carried on while she's in Rome. But her two visits are fairly brief.
How did the Egyptian people view Cleopatra as queen? And did it actually matter what they thought of her?
In the end, it probably doesn't matter what they thought of her. The opinion that can depose you, can get you killed or throw you out, is the opinion of the citizens of Alexandria, the big capital city, because they're right on your doorstep. If they start rioting, you're in trouble. Mm-hmm. And a few Ptolemies have been murdered. Several more have been chased out by them. But the people of Alexandria are largely Greek. They're largely more prosperous than the wider population that works all the farms and the estates in the countryside. It's very difficult to know what those people were thinking. And the odds are that Cleopatra was much the same, perhaps a little bit better, but not exceptionally so, as all the other Ptolemies. She doesn't face any rebellion of her Egyptian subjects, but she doesn't have grand support or enthusiasm either. But she is quite careful. We see from early in her reign that she's spending money and also perhaps some personal involvement in the traditional Egyptian religions. So installing one of these sacred bulls in one of the compounds where these animals were sort of pampered and watched all the way through their lives and seen as representatives of the gods on earth, even true gods themselves. She helps with one of that. She may even have actually taken part when she was only about 18 or 19 in one of the ceremonies. So she does try and win their support. She spends money on temples, but it's a very distant relationship. You know, she's there, she's a ruler, Egypt needs a ruler. But whether there was any emotion, there's not really any evidence for that.
So,
in the end, it's the people who have to pay for all the money that she's sending off to help the Romans. So, you know, she's using the kingdom and its resources for her own ends. The people aren't getting much from that.
So Julius Caesar famously is murdered on the Ides of March, and the republic essentially falls into chaos. The second triumvirate is formed. Talk a little bit about that and what it was meant to do.
It's very much a thing about personal power. Triumvirate just means sort of board of three or three officials. And Antony tries to seize power on his own after Caesar's murder, lasts for a while, but then gets chased out of Rome, declared a public enemy. Octavian, Caesar's adopted son, is used against him by the Senate. But then as soon as Antony starts to look as if he's going to be defeated, the Senate decides, well, let's get rid of Octavian. We don't need him anymore. So you've suddenly got two people who've both been chased out and think, well, the Senate doesn't want us. We're better off joining together. And they join with Lepidus, the third man who commands an army but is probably less of a forceful character, and go back, seize power by force, kill all their opponents. Men like Cicero die in the purge that occurs then. They kill other people just because they want their money. And they put together, effectively, it's a board of three, but they are dictators. And they're far more brutal and blatantly repressive than Julius Caesar had ever been. But they're there to establish power, and it's very much personal power. They claim they're restoring peace and prosperity and all this sort of thing, but really it's about themselves. One of their first tasks is to go off and catch Julius Caesar's killers. So they go off and fight Brutus and Cassius, and you end up with the battles of Philippi in northern Greece.
And they divide the power among themselves, but there's sort of an uneasy peace after this is all done.
It is. You have to remember that only a year or so ago, Octavian was fighting against Antony. Lepidus wasn't sure whether he could rely on either of them, and he's pressured into the alliance with Antony by his soldiers, who don't particularly want to fight against other Romans. So, you know, none of them really like each other. None of them trust each other. It's very difficult for Roman politicians to share power. They're fiercely competitive, and they always want to be the one in charge. So you add that element in with personal suspicion, personal dislike, and the whole thing is very dangerous, very precarious from the start. Within a few years, Lepidus will be eased out altogether. You just have Octavian and Antony, one controlling the west, one controlling the east, and sort of eyeing each other warily, looking for the first mistake, looking for the first weakness, not sure whether they can trust the other one. Should they strike first, or do they wait and, you know, let the other one start a civil war? But there's very little trust.
So how did Antony and Cleopatra come together as lovers?
Well, it's much later. That's the thing we have to remember. It's not until 41 BC, so it's 3 years after Caesar's been killed. But Antony's given charge of the eastern Mediterranean. Cleopatra is one of the important rulers in that area, one of the allies that Rome relies upon. And she's summoned to see Antony because at least one of her subordinates has helped Brutus and Cassius in their war effort against Antony and Octavian and the Triumvirate. She turns up in this incredible display of sort of pomp and ceremony that, you know, makes it into the Shakespeare play, where she rows along the river into Tarsus in this lavishly ornate barge. She's dressed up as Aphrodite, Isis. There are sort of cupids and nymphs running around on the deck, and everything's covered in gold and gems, and expensive perfumes and spices are sprayed into the air, all this sort of thing. And it's you know, trying to wow Antony when she arrives. There's this great tradition of display, of parades that the Ptolemies have, of sort of showing off their wealth. And she is essentially saying to him, look, I've got all this money, I've got all these resources, I can give them to you, and I can let you have them far more easily than you could try and get them if you took Egypt from me. So it's making herself useful, but it also becomes the personal bond very quickly. They're lovers, and again, just like when Caesar had spent a few months in Egypt, when he leaves, Cleopatra's pregnant. Same thing happens. Antony spends about 6 months with her. By the time he leaves, she's again pregnant. This time she'll give birth to twins. So she's sort of cementing that yes, I'll give you this political support, I'll give you the money, I'll give you the grain, I'll give you all these things you need, but I need your backing. I need you. And to make sure that he is always on her side, he's always keeping her in power, then it's just taking it that step further. Look, we're also lovers, we're close personally. But the politics is always there beneath the surface with both of them. And I think each realizes the other one is trying to get something from them, and that just adds a bit of spice to the whole affair.
Was Octavian bothered on a personal level? Obviously, there are political ramifications to this relationship. Was he bothered by the fact that Antony was, in fact, married to his, was it his sister, while he was cavorting with Cleopatra?
It's his sister. I mean, that happens after the first meeting, because there's a quarrel amongst the triumvirate, and they patch it up eventually. And one of the part of the deal is that Octavian's sister will marry Antony, and they go off and they quickly have two daughters. And for about 3.5 years, Antony is basically faithful to her, and they spend a winter in Athens, and they sort of celebrate there. And she does many of the things that Cleopatra did, but in a more sort of demure Roman way. You know, and Antony likes being flattered. He likes someone. He likes affection. He needs it, and he tends to respond to someone who gives him love. So that works, but the problem is when Antony goes back to the East in 37, he summons Cleopatra and doesn't let Octavia join him, and he never again sees Octavia. So that's when it breaks down. But it's to some extent it's an excuse. I mean, politically, Octavian had always been suspicious of Antony. Now, personally, he probably doesn't like him having an affair behind his sister's back, but also he still needs Antony for a while, and he isn't strong enough to oppose him. So it sort of makes the situation more tense, but it's several years before the relationship between Octavian and Antony breaks down and you end up with civil war.
Historian Adrian Goldsworthy is my guest. His new book is called Antony and Cleopatra. We'll come back to that archived interview with Adrian Goldsworthy in just a couple of minutes. Right now is the ideal time, since we are pausing from the interesting conversation. It's the ideal time for you to go online and make a contribution at kera.org or to call 1-888-694-6931. We have for you this afternoon, if you are interested in making a contribution at the $120 level or above, copies of Adrian Goldsworthy's book, Antony and Cleopatra. Really fascinating read for lovers of ancient history, for lovers of history in general, and honestly,
and ancient lovers
of ancient love stories. It is really a very dramatic story, and the personal relationship between Antony and Cleopatra is juicy and good.
Well, it was a great show, and as I said earlier, Chris, Adrian Goldsworthy is somebody when a new book by him pops up on the forthcoming list. I'm always really interested for the show because he's a great guest, and we're so excited to be able to bring you this special encore. He was on last September when the book was out, fresh and new, and we had an opportunity today to bring you a best of program, and that's the one we chose because it was just such a compelling story, and he's such a great storyteller that we're thrilled to do it. And you know what? We've heard from some of you who are thrilled to be part of KERA, Ray and Marty Allen in Corinth, Ron John Rout in Irving, Michael Moore in Sulphur Springs, Mr. and Mrs. Roger Stearman in Dallas, Mr. and Mrs. Tom Kuckelman in Dallas, and Andrew Birkenhoyer in Arlington. Thank you so much to each of you for your contribution at KERA.org or via the phone at 888-694-6931.
You make public radio necessary when you listen, and you make it possible when you make a contribution. All of us come together to make public radio. It wouldn't be here if it was just Jeff and Betsy and I and Nilifer wanting to do a radio station. We wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be here without you, because there'd be no one to serve. And honestly, there'd be no one to pay for the costs of making radio. No one to pick up the enormous tabs of putting programs like Morning Edition and All Things Considered and Fresh Air with Terry Gross on the air. No one to pay for this show, quite frankly. Your support makes it possible. And, you know, whatever amount you're able to give us, we put straight to work paying for and producing the content that you count on from this station. Please let us know that you appreciate it by going online to kera.org or by calling 1-888-694-6931.
1-888-694-6931 or via the web at kera.org. Again, we have a copy of Adrian Goldsworthy's book, Antony and Cleopatra, for you. When you join the station at the $120 membership level, you can put that on your credit or debit card online, and you know, you can just dust your hands and know that you've done your part. Or you can ask for an invoice. We'll send you an invoice. You can send a check to the station, or you can set up a sustaining membership. You can do that online as well. where you set it up so the station gets a $10 a month transfer from your account right to the station's account. You control the amount. You can let it go as long as you want. You can make changes to it when you want to. And you can set that up as a sustaining membership, which is actually a great way to support the station. Your membership's always current, and the station can count on you throughout the year for being a member and supporting the station with that little extra monthly allowance, if you will, that allows the station to do its job for you.
Yeah, from our perspective, a contribution, any way you want to do it is great. A sustaining membership is a little bit like having a salary job as opposed to, you know, maybe working freelance. When you make a contribution, and we're hoping that you'll come back, but we're never quite sure. But if it's been a while since you've made a contribution, maybe you joined a couple of years ago, you made a contribution, you felt good about it, you're still enjoying the station. Think back. We ask that everyone who listens makes a contribution at least once a year. So if it's been a while, if you can't quite remember the last time that you called that phone number, 1-888-694-6931. If you haven't called it since before we changed the phone number, it's time for you to make another contribution. Or, of course, you can always go online. That's my favorite way to take care of membership, is to go online to kera.org. And you can also check out the thank you gifts there. I'm not sure if we mentioned or if we still have any of the pairs of tickets that we had to see Stuart Copeland at this home concert event that sounds extraordinary. But can you give us the details again, Jeff?
Yeah, I was actually going to check and see if it's still available, but we'll assume that it is until someone's waving their arms down the hall. We started out with two pairs of tickets to see Stuart Copeland on Tuesday, February 1st. It's at the home of a Dallas Symphony Orchestra Guild member, and it's a private event. It's a private concert.
It's pretty cool. Really.
$350 contribution.
This is like the sort of thing that the glitterati attend, and perhaps you are glitterati. Or a glitterato. I'm not quite sure what the word is. Anyway, maybe you go to this sort of thing all the time. Jeff and I do not, and it sounds like a really exciting event. Plus, you will be supporting KERA at the same time you have this magical experience for yourself separate from that. Please let us know that you support KERA, that you believe public radio matters in our community, and that you want it to stay strong, and that you think KERA is doing a good job for you. Get on the phone and call us at 1-888-694-6931 or make a contribution at kera.org. If you make a $120 contribution or more, you can choose to receive a copy of Adrian Goldsworthy's book, Antony and Cleopatra. And again, we do have some of those tickets to see Stuart Copeland still available, so thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is historian Adrian Goldsworthy. His new book is called Antony and Cleopatra. So, Adrian, when Octavian finally has the resources and the motivation to declare war on Egypt and on all of Antony's holdings, it would seem in multiple cases like Mark Antony had the advantage in the conflict. He had more soldiers often. He had better equipment. Why did he keep losing?
Well, it's one of those things that Antony has spent the last 20 years or so telling everybody he's a great soldier. But by Roman standards, he hasn't spent a lot of time with the army. He hasn't really learned how to fight, how to lead a major force in a big campaign. And when he's tried this in 36 BC, and he's done what Caesar was planning to do before he died, he's launched a big invasion of Parthia, it's been a complete mess. About a quarter, maybe even a third of his army die. He achieves nothing at all. He loses most of their equipment, their baggage, straggles back through the mountains of modern-day eastern Turkey, and then abandons his men and gallops off back to the coast to the warm arms of Cleopatra. So Antony markets himself as a soldier, but he isn't actually very good at it. So he tends to rely on having big armies, big navies, big forces, but then he doesn't really know what to do to them. And whereas Octavian himself isn't that skillful a soldier, he has, as one of his agents, one of his main subordinates, a chap called Marcus Vipsanius Agrippa. And Agrippa turns out to be one of the ablest admirals, the ablest generals of his generation, of that era. And really, in the campaign in 31 BC, he takes Antony's forces apart quite systematically. And Antony doesn't seem to know what to do.
So the ultimate end of Antony and Cleopatra's reign came at the Battle of Actium, where again, it looked like Antony might have the resources to win. He made a really bad decision, though, in the thick of things.
He does. I mean, they arrange after they've been blockaded for a long time. They're running out of food. Disease is rife in the camp. They try and break out with the fleet. Now, that might have been fine if they'd got Cleopatra out and the treasury and the money and let her go. But instead, Antony gets on board a small ship and chases after the queen and then goes and sulks on the prow of the ship. But he abandons most of his fleet. He abandons all of his army. And that's the one thing a Roman politician, a Roman aristocrat, will never be forgiven for doing. You can lose a battle, but you have to stay with your men. You have to rally them. You have to get ready to fight again tomorrow. Running away is just absolutely beyond the pale. So once Antony does that, he's pretty much lost the war forever. There is never any chance of recovery, and it's not too long before his entire army deserts to the other side, because why should they stay and die for someone who won't stay with them? So he fails in the end, and the most crucial test for a Roman politician.
So let's talk about those famous suicides. Clearly they fascinated Shakespeare, who not only wrote the history play, but a very similar sequence of events plays out in Romeo and Juliet. Why did Cleopatra tell her servants to tell Antony that she was already dead?
I think she has very clearly decided that Antony can't be saved at this point. You know, Octavian is not going to let him live. So if she spreads the rumor that she's dead, Antony will either kill himself, which is probably the most likely, and, you know, Cleopatra must have known him very well, so she'd have a fair idea this is how he'd react, or maybe he'd flee off into the desert. Either way, she wasn't his problem, or she was no longer associated with him. You know, she could try and have a separate deal, talk to Octavian. Maybe she could settle with him. Maybe she could give the resources of Egypt to him in the same way she had to Caesar and Antony. She can, after all, claim she's been a loyal Roman ally all the way through. It was Antony that, you know, was the man on the spot, so she supported him. So I think she is quite cynically expecting him, one way or the other, to take himself out of the picture.
So he does, in fact, stab himself and then realizes that she's still very much alive.
Yes, and then you have the passionate encounter, and probably, I mean, some of her grief where she's supposed to tear her clothes and beat her chest, and, you know, she helps with the maids to sort of haul his body up into the mausoleum where she's sealed herself in with all her treasure. Some of that's probably genuine. I mean, he has been one of only two people that she could really consider an equal, that she can talk to on that sort of level, and she's spent the last 6-7 years with him. So, I mean, a major part of her life has been spent with Antony, but she's still thinking, well, I can talk to Octavian. And, I mean, it's 10 days before she takes her own life. And during that time, there's quite intensive negotiation. And she's obviously hoping that right at the last minute, she can say, look, you know, I'll be a loyal ally to you just as I was to him. I've always been good to the Romans. I've always been faithful. Let me either stay in power myself or perhaps pass the throne on to Caesarion or one of the other children so my line continues and I can live in dignified exile somewhere.
So she's in this state of, she's agitated over his death, she's grieving, she's feverish from some infected wounds that she has herself. Why did she take her life, though, in the way that it's been told to us that she did, either poisoning herself or having a snake brought in?
There was considerable doubt even at the time as to just how she did it. I think the decision comes because she's talked to Octavian and she's realized, and there are rumors, stories that several of his attendants, you know, feel sorry for and say, look, he's not going to give you anything. He wants you to parade in his triumph in Rome. You're not going to get the kingdom, neither are your children. And at that point, she decides, okay, I've tried to survive. And really, for Cleopatra to have lasted this long, survival means being in power. There isn't really an option of life otherwise because, you know, in the past, somebody else from a family would kill you. So she's found out that isn't possible. So I think then all the emotion for Antony comes back, all the sense of, well, you know, I've tried everything and he was close to me and all this sort of thing. So there's guilt and there's the sense of despair. But she tries to go out in a spectacular way. And it's rather like the theatrical quality of her life, you know, whether it's turning up in the great barge to greet Antony, whether it's being smuggled into Caesar in the bag. You know, she isn't just going to die quietly. It's got to be in a way that is, as her maid is supposed to have said when they found the body, you know, fitting for a queen and the descendant of so many great kings. How she actually did it was uncertain at the time. The story that circulates most quickly is that it's snake venom, snake bite, probably from the snake itself, but maybe from a hollowed-out hairpin or something like that containing venom. And then people start to argue about, well, you know, could you have had one snake that could kill both Cleopatra and the two maids who die with her? Well, I don't think we're ever going to resolve it because we don't know what happened with those three people locked in that that tomb. But the key thing was that she killed herself, that she did it in a way that made it absolutely clear. Even the Roman poets who months before had been ranting against her as this sort of dreadful Eastern harridan, this seducer of good, honest Romans, this terrible threat of sort of Eastern barbarism that was posed, suddenly they start to respect her. When she's dead, it's all about the bravery she showed, you know, the courage of this woman. She was more than a woman, because you have all these sort of patronizing ideas that she would take her own life rather than make that final surrender, rather than subject herself to, you know, the shame of being carried as a prisoner to Rome and all this sort of thing. So it's more that she did, perhaps, rather than the actual nuts and bolts, the details of how she did it. That's the thing I think we ought to focus on.
At the end of the day, you remind us here that Antony was always more powerful, more important, more of a threat to the powers that were in Rome than Cleopatra. Why do you think her legend grew to outstrip his after she was dead? Was it because of that dramatic exit?
A lot of it's that, but it's her whole life. I mean, Cleopatra has glamour. You know, it's interesting that the ancient sources do talk about her charisma, her personality, as the most overwhelming thing about her, you know, apart from looks and all that sort of thing. And it almost continues through. I mean, there is something so romantic about the idea of this queen who's trying her best, who only has two affairs, and they're with the two most important people in the world. You know, it's Caesar, then it's Antony. But also there's, you know, we're not, when you look at the ancient world, you very rarely have a woman appearing in a role of strength, of importance, and someone we feel we can get a sense of their character. You know, Roman women didn't have that degree of freedom. They couldn't have political power, not directly anyway. So there's all sorts that buy into this, and then we have the glamour and romance of ancient Egypt, which, even if she wasn't really from that world, it sort of feeds onto this idea of someone who is larger than life, spectacular. And whether people, you know, in the past sometimes people have vilified her as this sort of wicked temptress and all this sort of thing, or now she's a strong, independent woman doing her best in a man's world sort of thing, there is something powerful about Cleopatra. There's something special, something different about her.
I just want to ask you briefly, do you have a favorite ancient source of information, whether fully accurate or not, just for the joy of reading those old texts?
For Plutarch is always great fun, particularly mm-hmm. when you're reading the life of Antony, which is where we get so much of our information, not just about him, but about Cleopatra, because he tells us in one of his other lives that it's sometimes more interesting to tell you a joke that someone told rather than all the details of their political career or military campaign. And for a historian, that can be both frustrating, but it's also quite interesting because it brings the people to life more than just the bare deeds. You start to get a sense of what these people were like, whether it's stories of, you know, the time when Antony was out fishing and he'd sent men down to put fish on his line so that he could show off and impress Cleopatra. So she sends a slave down to hook a smoked fish that's come from hundreds of miles away and obviously been dead a very long time on the line to expose what he's been doing. And it's a big joke. You know, you get a sense of them as people, not necessarily very subtle, but there's something quite human, very intimate about it.
The new book by historian Adrian Goldsworthy is called Antony and Cleopatra. Adrian, it's been a really fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
And thanks to you for listening. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. If you loved this interview, if you would love to read Adrian Goldsworthy's book, we can send you a copy with our compliments when you make a $120 contribution to KERA or more. You can also do this online at kera.org, where it is super easy to pay with a credit or a debit card. And now, online, you can also set up your sustaining membership.
That's right. Chris Boyd. She's Chris Boyd. I'm Jeff Whittington. And you just enjoyed an encore presentation of, an archive show with Adrian Goldsworthy. And his book, Antony and Cleopatra, is available today. If you want a copy, your very own copy, you can join at the $120 membership level, as Chris said. Also, we have one last pair of tickets to see. Wait a minute. We're getting word.
Oh, they're gone. All right.
Never mind. I won't tell you about
the
great Stuart Copeland private lecture that you could have gone to see. Someone, and thanks so much to to each of you who contributed at the $350 level to take advantage of that. That's going to be really cool.
If you would still like to contribute about that level, but wanted a cool thank you gift, there is the day sponsorship, and that comes with a cool pre-recorded, I think you get 3 pre-recorded messages throughout a particular day on KERA, non-commercial messages, obviously, you know, say happy anniversary or congratulations or will you marry me or whatever. This is available as a thank you.
I don't think anyone's ever done that.
I know, but wouldn't
Will
it be cool?
Marry me?
There are people out there who listen all the time, and you'd know that right person. It would be darling.
Maybe you could. You just decide to marry someone just because you know they listen. That might be a great way.
That was a big attracting factor between me and my husband.
Really,
my husband and I.
Well, he obviously listened to you.
Yes, but he didn't. It was all before we met before the show began.
Oh, okay. All right. Very, very good.
Very briefly before the show began.
Nice save.
Anyway, let's stop talking about us. I think in the last hour I boasted about how it's never about us, and now it's
all
about me.
Let's talk about you, my friend.
1-888-694-6931 is the number that you can call.
That's right. You listen to this station, and you use this service. And you know what? It's up to you to make sure that KERA stays fiscally healthy and able to pay the bills. And look, here's the deal. Many of you are just going to say, well, I'll just leave it up to somebody else. And you're probably going to always do that, and you're just never going to give. So to a degree, although I think everyone can change.
I don't think there's anybody out there who's never going to give. I think everybody listening is eventually going to break down and think, it's not even like breaking down. You're not resisting a timeshare pitch here. This is content you already use.
But that's why we work so well together. Chris, you're the eternal optimist, and I'm kind of the resident
the
curmudgeon. And so, you know, I'm not the only, you know, you know, aged curmudgeon trapped in a younger person's body around here. But I'm one of them. But I do believe that there are those of you who are just never going to do it. And you know what? You get to decide. That's what's so beautiful about it, is it doesn't detract from the service at all, except that the service would be better if you would participate. But there are those of you who are going to give eventually. As Chris said, she believes all of you are in that camp, and I believe many of you are in that camp, and that someday you are going to give. Someday, whether it's today or tomorrow or 10 years from now, you're going to do it. Why not just make today the day? Why not make today that special day that you finally decided, okay, today's the day. I was always going to do it. I've always been meaning to do it. And today's the day I finally went to KERA.org, made a contribution, or I finally picked up that phone and dialed the toll-free number, 888-694-6931. On that, I am optimistic.
Surprise yourself and make a contribution. See how great it makes you feel. Thanks very much to Reverend Donald Burke and Dr. Ruth McClure in Dallas, to Mary and Harry Rorsch in Dallas, and Dr. Catherine Wellberg in Fort Worth. They have stepped up to support public radio, to support KERA, to support Think. We really appreciate it. You know, I think what happens, Jeff, maybe the resistance comes from the fact that in our society, we're accustomed, you know, we think we're smart because
you
always have to resist, right? Everything's a sales pitch. We're not trying We're not trying to sell you something you don't want or you don't need. We know you want it, and we know you need it because you're already here.
We're not even very good at selling it.
We're just asking you. I know, that's right. That's why we're in journalism. We're just asking you to pay for what you already want and need, what you have been using all this time, and what you will continue to use for the foreseeable future.
Yeah,
we're not asking so much.
We're not trying to butter you up and talk about how attractive you are. And
although you are.
How much faster you're going to run on your morning runs after you become a KERA member. Although you will.
Many good things will happen. Mostly what will happen is that your favorite radio station will be able to continue serving you. I mean, you know, we get it. It's tough times. Things are tight. We are having to be really, really careful with money right now here. Thanks to your support, we have not had to cut programming, which is wonderful. We're not even talking about it. We're talking about what we can continue to do to serve this community. Public radio is important. It's an important alternative to what else is out there. Maybe you go back and forth and you like both, which is great, but you also know how KERA is different. And one of the primary ways KERA is different, aside from the content, is in the way that it is supported by you at 1-888-694-6931 and at KERA.org.
Chris, I have a confession to make.
Oh, no.
I go back and forth.
You go back and forth from commercial to public.
I do.
You love them both.
I love radio.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be on a commercial station of my choice. And I'll be 2 or 3 minutes into a commercial stop set, and you go, "What am I doing?
I'm wasting all this time
to commercials." You know, they sneak it up on you. All of a sudden, you've listened to a couple of foundation repair commercials, or you've listened to, who knows, what, you know, some restaurant or some surgery center. I mean, you know, they're all viable, worthy businesses that support that programming. And, you know, because I listen to that programming, I'm in their target demo. But I always come back to KRA and go, oh, yeah, public radio.
And that's how you resist unnecessary foundation repair and plastic surgery.
Resist.
But don't resist making a contribution to KERA. It's so easy. It can fit into your budget because you decide the amount. 1-888-694-6931 or KERA.org. We do have copies of Adrian Goldsworthy's book, Antony and Cleopatra, available at the $120 level today. Thank you so much for your support.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.